This is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out for justice in this country.
If you've got to be militant to achieve your aims and your aspirations, so be it.
There's a real hypocrisy from the big corporations.
The people from below will push for real change.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
Welcome to the Indie Media Show on RTRFM 92.1. Before we go any further, a huge thank you to Jeff for On The Record, another excellent edition. Of course, you can catch On The Record every weekday at RTRFM from 9 a.m. in the morning. Also, big thanks to Michaela for the news. She'll be back at 12 o'clock to give you the RTRFM news updates. But as I said, this is the Indie Media Show. My name is Raymond Grenfell, and I'm joined by Brent Jones. How's it going, Brent?
Going very well, Ray. Yourself?
Yeah, keeping well. A little bit tired and sore from the Reclink training. If you haven't heard, there's the big RTR Reclink game coming up this Sunday. Down in Fremantle Oval. So get along to that if you want to support folks that are doing it tough and just see some, good to average to incredible footy. that should be a bit of fun. But I'm feeling a bit sore from that. But aside from that, I'm doing really well. A bit of a kind of a special edition of Indie Media in a way this week, in the sense that we're going to be kind of focusing on one issue and talking to a couple of people maybe with slightly divergent politics about it. We're going to be talking a little bit about some of the responses to COVID-19 over East, including the recent protests, if you want to call them, or some are calling them riots in Melbourne by so-called construction workers. I'm sure there are a few construction workers amongst them and others. Isn't that right?
Yeah, we are. We'll be talking to Tom Tanaki, who has obviously critiqued at length the anti-lockdown protest movement, the anti-vax movement, and how that has transformed throughout the last 12 months or so as we've gone through long restrictions over East. So that'll be interesting.
Yeah, totally. And I guess to get a slightly different perspective, but probably, definitely in the same ballpark, we're going to be talking to a longtime activist and socialist, Federico Fuentes, who's based in Sydney as one of the, casualties of perhaps the COVID-19 response. But, it's probably much deeper and broader than that is, of course, the resignation of Premier Gladys Berejiklian. And also today, as you would have just heard, Deputy Premier and Nationals leader in New South Wales, John Ballaro, has also resigned. And this is all coming after New South Wales Independent Commission Against Corruption announced that it was investigating former Premier Gladys Berejiklian. So we're going to be chatting to Federico Fuentes about, I guess, these resignations and the Gladys government, but also more broadly about how New South Wales has responded to the COVID-19 crisis and the impact that lockdowns has had on the community. And just some of the ways in which all sort of layers of the political spectrum have responded to the COVID-19 crisis. So lots to keep it locked to RTRFM for. That's what I'm trying to say. Bear with us. We'll wake up as the show progresses. But to kick things off this morning, we're going to go to a track by Omar Suleiman. This is Ya Bianya. You're on RTRFM 92.1, The Sound Alternative. And this is the Indie Media Show with Ray, Brent and Brahma.
Yeah, and I thought, Ray, since we've been talking about, the reactions to COVID-19, particularly over East, that we'd, if we wanted to know what was going on in Melbourne, we'd go straight to the source. Tom, how are you going?
G'day, how are you going? Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, no worries, mate. So what on earth has been happening on the streets of Melbourne over the last few weeks?
I mean, I suppose there's a broader story about the anti-lockdown movement and its various attempts to cultivate a big movement and to orchestrate, viral spectacle in the form of rallies and the like. But they really finished their spectacle-based tricks lately, I suppose, and they've started pretending to be other industries of people that they might have a few members of it, but they might not necessarily actually be representing. So most famously, we had a whole week of several days in a row of them pretending to be tradies. Now, when I say pretending to be tradies, there were tradies among them, but they sort of adopted a yellow vest movement adjacent, a high-vis spectacle, and you know, hundreds and then ultimately thousands of them poured into the streets over several days of protest. You know, it started out with a rally outside the CFMEU headquarters, ostensibly to get John Setka to capitulate and to start demanding mandatory vaccines be scrapped, demanding that of the government. And then that turned into a bunch of people marching on the Westgate Bridge and singing Horses by Darrell Braithwaite. And then the next day they ended up marching on the Shrine of Remembrance. And all, I suppose at that day they were pretending to be Anzacs, weren't they? Since then they've gone on and pretended to be aged care workers and nurses, and that's not the first time they've done that. More recently, they all pretended to be teachers last weekend, all wearing white and rallying there. And in all of these cases, I have absolutely no doubt there were a few anti-vax CFMEU members, teachers, nurses or the like that were actually joining their ranks. But the bottom line is that the anti-vax movement has now started to pretend to be a big collective of all these different industries of people, and you know, they are quite content to go and dress up in whatever, you know, cosplay it is that they need to do to be that industry. And it's working. It's making for some really effective viral spectacles. So that's what's basically going on lately.
Tom, it's been rather difficult to make heads or tails of a lot of this stuff being on the other side of the country, and it all being sort of filtered through, I guess, you know, corporate social media or mainstream media. And I guess, as you say there, that, you know, while it very much seems like some bizarre far-right anti-vax cosplay, there, I guess, is, you know, the reality that there are some people, members of the construction industry in this instance or others, that are genuinely frustrated. And I know it's been a bit muddied in terms of, and probably deliberately muddied in terms of, you know, the far right co-opting those genuine frustrations. Can I ask to what extent do you believe, though, that there were people demonstrating in those 3 days, the construction worker demonstrations, that were concerned about things such as the break rooms being closed down, and I guess the issue of mandatory vaccination for construction workers just being an issue that perhaps some people that aren't necessarily far-right or anti-vaxxers were concerned about?
Well, I often say to people that the anti-lockdown movement, the freedom movement, is not fundamentally far-right. It's fundamentally conspiracist. But the nature of the elements of the far-right, I suppose particularly when we think of far-right influencing elements within the anti-lockdown movement, we're talking about, say, for example, people who are white supremacists in Telegram groups trying to convince people that the actual, you know, people behind the NWO or whatever power conspiracy they have, that the actual people responsible are the Jews, you know. So that's the far-right ambient element within this conspiracist movement. But conspiracist movements are fundamentally a melting pot of everyone trading their different ideas back and forth and competing to see whose conspiracy is the most, you know, compelling, and which faction out of many different factions can win the day. So I only say that to say that I don't necessarily characterise those rallies that happened as being a series of only far-right people pulling the puppet strings on everyone there. And I also think that if we just do that, then we disregard the fact that, yes, to answer one of your questions, you know, there were people out on those days who were genuinely CFMEU members, or if not that, genuinely construction workers. There was quite a few toll people on that Monday at the CFMEU headquarters, for example, and they're not CFMEU, that's TWU. Nonetheless, they're unionists and they were there, you know. They were definitely there. And if we just talk about the far-right elements, then we risk both forgetting the nature of the anti-lockdown movements, which is, you know, a bad analysis is useless to us because it helps support us from actually understanding what we're dealing with. So it ain't all just... you know, far right, but it also isn't all just, you know, anti-vaxxers pretending to be construction workers. And the reason that that's important to think about is because, you know, John Setka's vacillating on the subject of mandatory vaccination or vaccination itself, you know, constantly trying to not being seen to be annoying or putting offside this rather small anti-vax base within his own union. The fact that he did that, he essentially invited this problem into his door. The only reason that elements within the anti-lockdown movement realised that CFMEU would be a rich and potentially powerful target was because, well, not only because they could see the attention due to the breakout ban, you know, the indoor tea room ban that you saw, they saw that the attention was on the union movement, but they saw that it was a loose thread. It was a point of weakness. And the reason it was a point of weakness was because SETCA had refused to take any firm stance, you know? And I said this from the start. I was saying this before they marched on the CFMEU. He was inviting this kind of attitude in there or this potential weakness because, you know, I mean, any union that doesn't care about the health and safety of its own workers isn't worth it, you know, it's just not a worthwhile union, frankly. And we don't necessarily need to see that the union is supporting a government mandate, but frankly, I think that a union that cares about the health of its own workers should be doing its own mandate. You know, I would want to see that the CFMEU are making sure that workers are mandated to get a vaccine as part of their union membership if they want to go and work on a union job, not waiting for the government to mandate and then saying, oh, we worry a little bit about that. What they're effectively doing when they were sitting on the fence was trying to absolve themselves, abdicate responsibility to the government. What they ended up doing was inviting this problem in. So really it was a hodgepodge. It's a real mixed bag of some anti-vaxxers pretending to be construction workers and far-on elements admittedly. Yes, there were some of them, but conspiracist movements are a very mixed bag and currently they're just getting much better at figuring out who to target.
Yeah, absolutely, Tom. A lot of the footage that was that's been floating around shows a very heavy police presence in Melbourne. Sort of some things that we probably haven't seen here before: rubber bullets, you know, capsicum spray, and you know what? Obviously, that's quite a concerning development. Is that something that you think will continue in Melbourne for different, you know, important activism?
There's very strange conversation with conspiracists or anti-lockdown types in which they think that my disapproval for the anti-lockdown movement suddenly somehow means that I'm approving of the abhorrent police overreach, you know, of protest. You know, the reality is that I've been staring it in the face and, you know, as part of activist movements in Melbourne for years prior to when most of these people, I assume, ever even cared. And I think that what we have seen is horrendous, the police violence there. But it shouldn't be forgotten that it's an incremental, you know, increase in police, you know, violence and pounds. For example, certainly what they have done that I haven't seen them doing before is the rolling out of the rubber bullets. But that didn't just happen last night, you know. It didn't happen overnight. That those powers, you know, although that technology, that equipment was introduced in, I think, 2017 or 2018, and it was part of a spread of reforms that were all these powers and equipment was given to the port team. That's the police. Sorry, the port team is like the riot squad and the protest control squad in Victoria. And those powers were given into them years ago, voted in over successive Daniel Andrews Labor governments as part of the law and order reform packages. So, you know, people were voting for this thing because they thought it was going to protect them invariably from other protest elements. They weren't thinking of a pandemic coming along. They were thinking of far left, far right demonstrations or environmentalist demonstrations at those times. So I've already seen all the pepper spray. I've seen a young woman get both of her legs broken by a police force. I've seen all the violence. I've scared at it all. It's already been happening. We've always decried it. Is it true that it's getting worse? Absolutely, you know. But what we're hoping, you know, do I expect that after the, you know, the pandemic is done and there aren't orders to stay at home, suddenly the VicPol are never, ever going to go to the same horrendous lengths that they've done so again? No, I'm pretty sure that they're going to keep some of the stuff on board. But you can't But, you know, I don't really blame this on the anti-lockdown movement any more than I enjoyed being blamed for the increase in police powers back when they were, you know, Daniel Andrews was giving them all this equipment back when we were hitting the streets to counter the far right. You can't blame that on people. It is within the nature of, you know, the state and federal Australian government and its, you know, stormtrooper contingent that they increase their surveillance and their violence capabilities. That is within their nature. It's our responsibility eventually to start fighting back against that. But we can't do it right now because there's a pandemic, and I believe in staying at home where I can.
We're speaking to Tom Tanuki from Melbourne, long-time comedian, journalist, activist, and someone who's very much been following the developments in Melbourne and around Australia in regard to the anti-lockdown protests. Tom, what you're talking about there really speaks to, I guess, the difficult position that the left has been in over this last year or more than a year, really, in responding to the COVID-19 pandemic. There's been a real fracturing of the left with, I guess, some more libertarian elements, perhaps supporting some of the anti-lockdown movements, whereas you've got other members of the left, like socialist groups and liberals, taking on positions that seem somewhat contrary to the tradition of left-wing politics and supporting governments such as the McGowan government here in WA or the Andrews government there. As you've said, of course, the Andrews government in Victoria have introduced a whole slew of horrendous sort of law and order policies. You know, by no means can, even in the liberal sense, they can be considered a progressive government, but it really seems as though the left have been somewhat lost as to how to take a position. As you said there, the pandemic is real. We should be supporting vaccines, but then often many on the left are finding themselves in a position where they're not only supporting vaccines, they're supporting quite arbitrary and authoritarian measures. And as you said there also, you know, states and corporations are obviously exploiting this crisis. We've seen that particularly in places like France with the introduction of the global security law and all around the world where states have thought, oh, this is great, let's exploit the pandemic and introduce all these insane draconian laws. It's really difficult, I think, as someone, you know, on the so-called left, if it even exists anymore, to really formulate a nuanced and critical position. Do you see it happening anywhere? Do you see any sort of, I guess, movements or groups that can actually both maintain their vigilance around the pandemic, but also maintain their criticism and their activism around this creeping sort of authoritarian capitalism?
Yes, I see elements of the left online, thinkers, philosophers, activists and the like, trying to flesh out a middle road that makes sense. And when I say middle road, that sounds dangerously close to me talking about being centrism, what have you, and I don't mean to say that. I'm talking about a way in which you acknowledge the fact of the public health crisis. And you try to support what, you know, there's a Marxist geographer called David Harvey who talked about the real working class of the pandemic is healthcare workers and the like. And so you therefore try to support the struggle of the real working classes in those underpaid, often marginalised, often female, often migrant workers who break their back trying to save people's lives and are so often ignored. Their crisis and their struggle is so often ignored through the pandemic. How do we support them? Those people who shoulder the burden of the world around. How do we do that whilst also criticising the overreach of the police, whilst also not adding to outbreaks by getting out there, you know, when there are outbreaks on? How do we do all of those things at once? And you've got to get your terms right. So I'm looking for people these days, and I'm sure many other lefties are as well, who articulate those points right. You know, so I do see it happening. I see a struggle for the left to try and define what it stands for in a point where there's so many competing different priorities. And, you know, for me, I believe in trying to prioritise and share the information of and get us to participate in mutual aid. And I'm someone that spends a lot of my time and has an audience for talking about fringe conspiracist elements and their rallies, you know, like the anti-lockdown movement and the like. So, you know, I do talk about that stuff, but as a little bit of an offset, as a kind of a carbon offset for all my talking about people, I try to encourage people's participation in mutual aid, which I think is far more important than countering a rally that we don't enjoy. You know what I mean? That we don't agree with because we believe that there's far-right elements in there. I think that we always need to be loud and vocal, whether it be online or otherwise, in criticising the over-policing of the pandemic, because it will hit us next. But I don't necessarily think when there's a public health crisis on that we should be doing that boots on ground out at rallies. Yes, we want to reject cops and nanny states and the capitalist impulse that lets rugby grand finals and the like happen to with nearly full capacity whilst small business owners can't even let people in, you know, whereas these massive events with the highest bidders and the mass biggest profits, they're allowed to happen and the onus ends on being on the attendees. So we see the capitalist impulse there. You know, only big business survives while small business suffers, and this government has all but given up on supporting people to stay at home. You know, we believe that, you know, I believe over here that you cannot actually do lockdowns. You may as well not do them if you're not giving people assistance to stay at home. This is why a lot of the countries around the world haven't done lockdowns. But we have a strong tradition for all of our, you know, our government's capitalist ways and the like. We do have a tradition of social welfare nets. And in fact, in 2020, we did have a pretty reasonable one with JobKeeper and JobSeeker and the like. We need to have that introduced because, again, you can't ask people to be locked down. Melbourne's now the most locked down city in the world. It doesn't work. And you look at the case stats, there's the proof. It doesn't work unless people actually can stay at home. So we need to be demanding that. We need to figure out ways to do it in which we don't hit the street and contribute to outbreaks. Really difficult, but we've got to get our terms right, first of all.
Absolutely. Tom, you've got a fringe show, Lockdown Ode. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, this has been a really serious, heavy chat.
Oh, yeah, well, you know, there's nothing wrong with a serious, heavy fringe show, you know.
Well, you know, yeah, it's just felt a bit odd going, hey, after this really serious, heavy chat, would you like to come along and enjoy my fringe?
You just have to get really drunk before you watch it online for it to be funny and just laugh at it from the absurdity of the, you know, a world-ending perspective.
That's it. Well, look, you know, what the show is about is there is a bit of comedy. I would describe it as a bit comedy, a bit spoken word, a bit of a bizarre nightmare sequences in there. Just watch it. It's enjoyable. It is a meditation, I suppose, on a little bit of the pandemic, particularly the early pandemic, as in sitting home and frying whilst looking at anti-lockdown and conspiracists, and particularly supermarket fighting videos, and then going to the supermarket and the like, and the effect that that has on someone. So it's sort of my semi-arty approach to dealing with that. And I don't think, you know, I think there's going to be more and more pandemic art in the future. You know, we're going to have to, this is not a fad anymore. This is the world we live in now for the foreseeable future. So I tried to do early pandemic themed meditation on some of these things. So that's happening from tomorrow until Saturday. It is a digital show, so you can park it on your couch at home and watch it. It's called Anti-Lockdown Ode. And it's a fringe festival. Tickets are cheap, $10, $5 if you're really broke. Get along. Please come along and watch.
Sounds fantastic. And what a world that we're living in with paleo-fascists and pandemic art and, you know, people talking about, you know, horse tranquilizer. We didn't even get to talk about horse tranquilizer today or horse dewormer or whatever the hell it is. It's a wild world and... Yeah, we're glad that we've got you at least commentating on it and, you know, giving us a bit of an insight. So thanks very much for joining us today, Tom Tanuki.
Thanks so much for having us.
Cheers, mate. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you. See you later.
Indie Media Show on RTR FM 92.1. Going to go to a track now by Salary, and then we're going to return to this, this special on the lockdowns, on COVID-19 pandemic. And very shortly, we're going to be chatting to Federico Fuentes, who is a longtime activist in Sydney. But as I said, right now, here is Salary with One Friday, I Was Bored.
You're listening to the Indie Media Podcast, first broadcast on RTR FM 92.1.
And you are on the Indie Media Show on RTR FM 92.1. If you've just joined us, we're talking a bit about the COVID-19 pandemic and the lockdowns and some of the response to that, including, of course, the demonstrations in Melbourne recently, but just more broadly, how all layers of the political spectrum have responded to the crisis. Now, I guess the latest casualty, in a sense, from the COVID-19 pandemic, of course, it's probably much deeper and broader than that, though. But one of the latest casualties really is the impact it's had on the New South Wales government. On Friday, Premier Gladys Berejiklian resigned shortly after the New South Wales Independent Commission Against Corruption announced it was investigating her. But this was only the beginning, as shortly after Transport Minister Andrew Constance yesterday announced he'd be exiting state politics to pursue his ambitions in Canberra. And this morning, Deputy Premier and New South Wales Nationals leader John Barilaro revealed he was going to discuss these, quite, I guess, dramatic changes in New South Wales politics and more broadly some of the responses to the COVID-19 pandemic. We're now joined by a longtime social justice activist and journalist, Federico Fuentes. Thank you so much for joining us, Federico.
Oh, thank you. It's always a pleasure to be on the show.
Now, if we could just start with these resignations of Berejiklian and particularly Barilaro that was revealed this morning. Does it come at all as any surprise to you, given how they've managed the crisis in New South Wales?
There's an element of surprise perhaps in the timing, but I think, certainly the allegations surrounding Gladys Berejiklian and her secret relationship that she had with a former member of the government who was forced to resign, and the allegations, or certainly on the public record, that he was providing her information, even though it's not alleged that she was involved in any wrongdoing, but she had knowledge of wrongdoing from her former partner, and that's really what ICAC has now announced. The Commission Against Corruption has announced that they'll be carrying out an investigation into her. So I think once that became public, it was only a matter of time before Gladys Berejiklian resigned. In fact, it's been quite common, both the allegations of corruption for Liberal premiers, but also for them to very quickly stand down once any allegations have come into public. Perhaps the Barilaro one is a little bit more surprising. He has previously mentioned his wantingness to step down from state politics. He'd said he was possibly thinking about a tilt at federal politics, but he's basically said, look, it's all been a bit too much for me. I think now's my time to step out of politics. I doubt he's going to step out completely. I'm sure that he'll continue to do something else. But the fact you've had both those two, the two highest positions in the government resign, and as well as you've mentioned the Transport Minister announced that he would be resigning, and many knew that he was possibly going for a tilt at a federal seat. So again, that not surprising, but perhaps the timing is means that now we have a situation where already with the coalition here being a minority government, with two of its MPs moving to the crossbenches, and now have three by-elections that will occur, which could potentially result in a change of government, even if the seats that those three MPs currently hold are very relatively pretty safe seats for the coalition, with anything from 7% to 12% sort of swing margins required.
Now, this is all happening in the midst of the COVID-19 crisis. Just yesterday, Greater Sydney entered its 100th day of, restrictions and lockdowns since the initial outbreak started in June 16th. It's quite had a huge impact on Sydney, and this has obviously come after an initial response from New South Wales government that was very resistant to lockdowns. Broadly, if we can just start by looking at the state government's response to the crisis and its use of lockdowns, it's obviously had a huge impact on working people in Sydney, and there's been quite an incredible sort of militarisation of the police, and there's a lot of issues obviously connected to it. But do you see a connection to these recent I guess, developments in state politics and the response to the COVID-19 crisis, particularly, you know, the ways in which people are starting to respond to the state government's handling of the crisis?
I think it's certainly possible to say, perhaps in the case of Barilaro, that, you know, the intense media pressure that's been brought to bear on New South Wales during this COVID outbreak has contributed to his wantonness to step away from the limelight. But I don't think that the overall government's response to COVID has been a significant factor. In fact, I'm sure that, for instance, if ICAC hadn't announced it was going to investigate Gaia Sperigigli, I don't think there's any evidence to suggest that she would have resigned. And in fact, the polling largely continues to show, you know, a decent amount of support both for Gladys Berejiklian, but also for her response to COVID. So I don't think the actual government's response to it has been a triggering factor. But it will, of course, now be interesting to see how that plays out in the by-elections, because we do know that, of course, it will be an issue in the by-elections, the handling of the COVID crisis. It's also going to be in the background of a looming federal election, where, of course, Labor is also trying to make Morrison's COVID response a key element of the election campaign. So it will be an interesting test to see what actually happens in these regards. And, of course, it's always difficult for a sitting government with by-elections. The tendency is generally to vote against the sitting government, so you would expect some swings away from the Liberals. But as I said, they're going to require some pretty monumental swings for Labor to be able to win those seats and then potentially form a government. But with that will be something that will be very interesting to see in those election campaigns.
Federico, if we can talk a little bit about, I guess, some of the state government's responses to the COVID-19 crisis. I mean, as I mentioned there before, Greater Sydney has entered its 100th day or 101 Thursday, sorry, of lockdown or restrictions today. And I think, you know, broadly the left, in whatever counts for the left these days, has had a bit of a difficulty in terms of formulating, I guess, a platform or a response to how to deal with the COVID-19 crisis in general. I don't think it's sort of controversial to say that. I think there's been some elements of the left who have quite sort of happily sort of sided up with governments that they would otherwise usually oppose, and particularly with sort of tactics that otherwise oppose. And it's I think it's been quite difficult for people to form a nuanced position, particularly when it comes to lockdowns, and particularly in places such as Sydney, where lockdowns are clearly affecting working class people a lot more than, I guess, upper or middle class people. What's, I guess, your sort of broad position been on the way in which the left has responded to the lockdowns, responded to some of the frustrations of workers in New South Wales?
Yeah, I think this is a critical topic. And I think one of the big things that we've seen throughout the sort of COVID crisis of the last 19 months is the real inability for many progressives sort of to break out of the sort of two-party mentality and essentially become cheer squads for one side of politics, blinded to any of the errors that may be occurring on that side, and, you know, sort of a complete demonisation of the other side. And this has been very much clearly played out in the way different state governments' responses to COVID have been taken. In actual fact, there's by and large much more agreement than there is disagreement between the ways that Liberal governments in New South Wales, Tasmania, South Australia have dealt with COVID, as Labor governments have done in Western Australia, Victoria, Queensland. They've all by and large had the same focus, which is, on the one hand, trying to figure out how to deal with a global pandemic, first time they've been thrown into this, and we're huge public pressure and sort of seeing the responses of other places around the world, starting from China and then Europe, of governments locking down society. By and large, being happy, you know, to move in that direction. But always with a focus on ensuring that business, it wasn't business that paid the cost of these lockdowns. So those lockdowns always came with very big subsidies for business, but very, very marginal improvements for those on, say, for instance, JobSeeker, or in many cases, you know, loss of hours and wages for workers, even under the previous JobKeeper program. But we're seeing, I mean, even Tasmania today still you know, saying that it's got basically has a similar position to Western Australia. It's going to keep its state borders shut until over 90% vaccination. We've seen the New South Wales government willing to do local lockdowns, for instance, like it did in December. But the one thing that sort of perhaps makes New South Wales a bit of a different state is that, unlike many of the other states, its health department hasn't been completely gutted by years and years of neoliberalism. Now, there's, you know, a whole reason for that. But it actually has, you know, for instance, it's one of the only, it's the only state health department that has its own, you know, large-scale contact tracing, but also testing pathology labs. Every other state has basically had to outsource all that work because it just didn't exist. So this did exist in New South Wales. So what it meant was that New South Wales was able to escape a number of times from having to go into lockdowns because it had this healthcare infrastructure. So people forget that when the Melbourne second wave happened last year, there was an outbreak here in New South Wales. In fact, a couple of different outbreaks that all occurred around the same time. But New South Wales was able to snuff that out without a lockdown because it had a much higher ability to carry out basic things like testing, contact tracing, home isolation and quarantining of those with COVID. So it escaped that that time without having to do any lockdown. Similarly, in December, it was able to target its lockdown measures to very specific suburbs, in this case being the Northern Beaches. It was able to do the similar thing earlier this year. Delta, though, was a game changer in many ways. New South Wales, it's been shown that no system really is able to keep up with this virus, and so New South Wales wanted to realise that this was no longer going to be able to be controlled with just contact tracing and testing. Moved in to do lockdown measures, but it did so again in just the same way that all the other governments have done that, which is punitive measures that focus on saying that the individual is the problem. The problem is the individual person, and not the problem isn't the fact that the government isn't providing the necessary protective measures in workplaces, the necessary income support to be able to get people through these lockdowns. And so what we've seen is that during this whole time, for many progressives, we sort of forgot that the initial lockdowns were really only there because they were necessary but extremely devastating in terms of their impact on working class people measures to curb that first wave, to bide some time, to get us in a position where we can move away from having a reliance on lockdowns. How to do that? Build up healthcare capacity. Almost no state has done that, though, in the last 18 months. In fact, Queensland actually cut spending to health earlier this year. It's just sort of mind-boggling in the middle of a pandemic. Vaccination, we've seen the utter failure of the rollout. But rather than sort of focusing and criticising those elements, income support, the paid pandemic leave, these kind of things that could have ensured that people, when they were sick, stayed at home rather than went to work and infected others in their workplace. All of that was rolled back. But rather than focusing on those issues, it seemed to become this idea that somehow lockdowns were not just a stopgap measure, but the tool to solve a global pandemic. And what we're seeing now is that we're paying the price of that because as the rest of the world is opening up, and of course there are still ongoing issues. So I'm not trying to pretend that COVID is gone. And we still see outbreaks occurring all over the world, and of course we never hear about it in the news, but large swathes of outbreaks and deaths continue to occur in the global south, but they don't even make a register on the news. And all we've seen is we lost a lot of that time focusing on a measure which, when you think about it, is a kind of ironic measure because it's a measure where it is implemented where you simultaneously still have most of the cases and deaths and hospitalisation occurring in those same working class poor communities that are also bear the most brunt of those measures. It almost makes you think that perhaps these measures, the lockdown measures, are there to protect others and not necessarily those that most need it.
Federico, we've also seen, I guess, broadly from the left, a shift from, as you rightly said there, critiquing the neoliberal state government's lack of healthcare services, lack of vaccine rollout, or just totally bungling vaccine rollout, rather than using that as a great opportunity to really critique and confront the impacts of neoliberalism in this country, there's been this real shift to blaming individuals, as you're talking about there. And you can see that particularly of the ways in which the left have responded to some of the anti-vaxxers. Finally, are you worried that this sort of lack of a nuanced and critical position by many layers of the left has left a lot of working class communities and people open to being manipulated and essentially sort of recruited by the far right anti-vaxxers?
Well, look, even prior to COVID, you know, we're already seeing both in Australia but elsewhere just growing discontent and distrust of politicians, of the political class, if you want to go even as far as say, the distrust of the system as a whole. We're seeing that reflected in all sorts of ways. What I think concerns me is the reaction that large swathes of the progressive left have taken to the current situation, which is essentially to align itself with the status quo, with precisely that political class of which there is so much discontent directed against. And just sort of quite sort of without much opposition at all, allowed that political class to take away some pretty fundamental rights, really. I mean, it's sort of hard to imagine. I mean, if people, you know, you sort of hear the comment that you never thought you had to legislate for the right to be able to go and visit your parents because you just thought that would just be a fundamental right that would never be taken away. Now, and it has been in this context. Now, we can have the arguments about why it was necessary or all these other things, but you know, we see things like curfews being implemented, curfews that are generally only implemented literally under military dictatorship times. There's very few other times that are all huge political unrest. So they're very authoritarian measures. And here have been, you know, some of the progressives have been the most vocal about defending such measures that are always used just to police working class communities. So you have, this, on the one hand, discontent in these precisely in these areas that are traditionally, in many cases, places that formed the base of the left or voted for the left or supported the left. Now we have the left actually in many cases turning on them and supporting state measures being implemented against them. Maybe saying, oh, well, if we were in, we would maybe do it a bit differently, or you know, we would maybe give you a little bit more income support. But all of this does mean is that there's fertile grounds for more conservative, for more reactionary forces to really make a move in there. And I think it's clear that they are trying to do that, but I also don't think it should be overstated. I don't think we should pretend that all those, you know, anti-vax marches or all of those anti-lockdown marches that we've seen on the streets are all, you know, card-carrying members of the National Socialist Party. The reality is it's a broad mix of people. You can see that whether it comes to age, although you see that it is a lot of young people there. You could see that in terms of ethnicity, much more multicultural protests, certainly the one here in Sydney. Very, very Western Sydney focused, which is not your traditional sort of far right sort of support base, and people that, you know, on many cases sympathise with other ideas that the left have. So this important thing that we're going to have to grapple with, you know, how we can both simultaneously avoid the increasing support that or traction that the far right is gaining in these circles. And how the left can, you know, regain a hearing, not just necessarily amongst those people at the lockdown protests, because they're just one symptom of a broader malaise. But yeah, there is certainly an increase in, as I said, distrust of political class, a feeling that democracy is under siege. This predates COVID. COVID has only sort of sharpened a lot of this. And so the left has to re-engage with a discussion of how we can move away from just sort of advocating for nice moral values, but actually for real defence of rights, including civil and democratic rights, because we can be sure that COVID may at some point go away or just become, you know, just one more of the many different viruses we have to deal with every day. But many of the measures that have been implemented over these last 18, 19 months are unlikely to go away, because usually once the political class has been able to implement such measures, they're quite happy to keep them on the books, even if they may not need to use them in the immediate future.
We've been speaking to Federico Fuentes, a long-time social justice activist and journalist based in Sydney. Thanks so much for speaking to us today, Federico.
Oh, thank you for the opportunity.
And this is the Indie Media Show on RTRFM 92.1. We've pretty much run out of time. Thanks so much for joining us for the last hour. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, it's been great. And been some really good, nuanced, critical conversation.
And I think it is really good to just quickly, you know, discuss the fact that it's important to have these conversations. I think a lot of us have been a bit afraid to talk about it, but it's good to, you know, both acknowledge the reality that we are living in a very, very dangerous pandemic, but also that doesn't mean we have to stop being critical of the ways in which governments and corporations are exploiting the pandemic. And it's difficult, it's confusing, and it's complicated, but you know, people of a progressive conscience need to think about it and to discuss it and to actually formulate responses that are both simultaneously addressing the health crisis but also ensuring that we don't lose all of our civil and democratic rights.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very murky water to sort of to deal with, but you know, you can acknowledge that whilst lockdowns work and these kind of things need to happen, particularly vulnerable people, aged care is, you know, you should be vaccinated. If there is an outbreak, you shouldn't be having a whole bunch of people walk through those kind of things, but it's important to look and to keep critical on that kind of legislation and what that might mean in a different context.
Totally. We hope you've enjoyed the program. If you want to restream it, you can always head along to rtrfm.com.au. You can also find the show up there as a whole podcast, and you can also listen to a bunch of our individual interviews at our SoundCloud. We'll be back next week at 11 a.m. Keep it locked, though, to RTRFM now, though, as Rhianne Todhunter is going to take you out to lunch. That's all of your new music needs for a Monday afternoon. But Michaela is coming up very shortly with the RTRFM news updates. As I said, we'll be back next week. Thanks so much, Brent.
Thanks, Ray.
Thanks, Brahma, as well. Keeping up the positive vibes. Going to end the program today, though, with a track by Bikini Cops. This is their track, Stupid System. But as we say every week on the Indie Media Show,
don't hate the media.
Become the media.
Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?